Today we're going to explore one simple idea. But we're going to give this idea some color based on some very interesting historical context. And the idea on the one hand is rooted in history, but on the other hand it's very pertinent to our lives across the generations, but I think even more acutely and more directly during this unusual period that we find ourselves in now, this coronavirus period, where so many interesting halachic questions have come up, and our sages, the current rabbinic leadership of our generation, is giving us guidance. The thesis, the idea that we're going to explore today, which is a lesson that comes to us from France, as we will see, is the notion that rabbinic guidance is a partnership between Rabbanim and the community. That's the idea. The story today begins on July 29th, 1806, in Paris. There was a senior member of the French government, which was led by 1806, who's the leader of France? Short, stocky man? Napoleon. That's right, Napoleon. So Napoleon is the emperor of France. At the same time, in Eastern Europe, many of the great Gaonim Gedolim in Hungary and in Poland, both in the world of Lithuanian traditional rabbinic learning and in Hasidus, you know, there's a whole Jewish world, and then there's Napoleon. There's a lot of debate about who should support Napoleon and the Alter Rebbe and others. So there's a lot going on in the world. July 29th, 1806, a man by the name of Count Mole, M-O-L-E, with a little schmitschik over the E, he sends a letter to the Jewish community. This letter contains 12 questions. The questions get to the heart of an issue. And what's the issue? The issue is, what is the relationship between Jews and their country, their host country, which is France? In particular, as you know, over the generations, many Jews were restricted from various kinds of employment. So in many instances, they resorted to lending money, which was causing economic issues for peasants and farmers living specifically in the Alsace-Lorraine area, which is, if you're looking at a map, and France is here and Germany is here, Alsace-Lorraine is like right here, right on the edge. And every 5 minutes when there are wars, some days it's Germany, some days it's France. So Napoleon is controlling this area now, of course. Napoleon's stretching way out. And people are upset. And they come to Napoleon and say, we have a problem with Jews. They're not the first or the last people to say we have problems with Jews. So Napoleon, after hearing a lot of chatter, finds out that Jews are a very distinct bunch, and that some of their distinctiveness is potentially leading to this harmful economic situation. So you have people who are complaining, and they're saying the Jews are different, and they're not getting along with us, and they're taking usury. So Napoleon tells this guy, among a few others, well, we have to figure out, are Jews and is Judaism compatible with being French? You know, after the French Revolution, we're all égalité, fraternité, liberté, everything, we're all in this together. So what does it mean to be Jewish and French? Well, for example, can Jews marry French people if they're not Jewish? What's the law? Can Jews take money with interest from other Jews? And what about from non-Jews? This is an absolutely fascinating episode in Jewish history. The answers to these questions are not for today's discussion, although they are very fascinating. If you're interested in reading more on this in the compendium in The Jew in the Modern World by Mendes, Flohr, and Reinhardt, they have a whole section on these documents. So Count Mole presents these questions to the Jews. It was on the 30th of May, if you backtrack a little bit, that Napoleon formally issued the decree, and I'll quote it to you in the English translation. According to an account given to us in several northern departments of the empire, by the way, online you can find some of the documents related to this. It's very fascinating. The University of Chicago had an exhibition on a bunch of things from the period of this, which we'll get to the definition of this. Certain Jews, whose only profession is that of usury, have, by the accumulation of the most immodest interest, put many farmers in these lands in a state of great distress, of the greatest distress. On the 15th of July, in our fine town of Paris, here comes the key line for us right now, an assembly of individuals professing the Jewish religion and living in French territory shall be created. The members of the assembly shall be in the number here adjoined, which is 111, taken from the departments here listed and selected from amongst the rabbis, the house owners, and other Jews distinguished by their probity and their enlightened nature. Correspondence de Napoleon, lair number 10291, if you're looking this up on your phone right now. Who did Count Molay address? He addressed a group of people, an assembly. And they are known in English as the Assembly of Jewish Notables. They met 5 times between July and September of 1806. And they came up with a group of answers, specific answers to this question. Napoleon, to confirm that these answers were binding, so to speak, on Jews, thereby decided to convene another body called the Sanhedrin. Napoleon decided the fact that there is an assembly of Jewish notables, that's very good, but we need a Sanhedrin. So Napoleon decides we're going to have a Sanhedrin. And so he convenes a Sanhedrin. He officially appoints it on October 6th, 1806. They convene in Paris on the 9th of February of 1809, and they met until March 9th. On April 6th, they formally accepted the answers to these questions, and they wrote them up in French and in Hebrew, and they sent them to Napoleon. So this is the period known as the Napoleonic Sanhedrin. Fascinating. So the first step was the Assembly of Jewish Notables. Then it was Napoleon's Sanhedrin. Just so you should be aware, and I'll show you a picture. This comes from the Encyclopedia Judaica. The Napoleonic Sanhedrin, the Assembly of Jewish Notables and the Napoleonic Sanhedrin, they were a group of very wide spectrum, you could say, of Jews. Many of them were not traditional Jews. And as it said in the Assembly of Jewish Notables, many of them are just lay leaders, which is what I want to come back to in a little bit. But the head of the Napoleonic Sanhedrin is none other than Rav David Zinsheim. So I don't know if you could see this on the screen. This is the screenshot. This is the screenshot from the Encyclopedia Judaica. Great hat. No? Fantastic hat. Rav David Zinsheimer. Rav David Zinsheim was a very chashva individual. He wrote a series of Svarim. I think we have 14 volumes of Chidushei Torah called Yad David. Special shout out to my parents because he was the chief rabbi of Strasbourg. So thanks to my parents, I had the chance years ago in college to visit France and to study French Jewish history for several weeks. And I was actually in Strasbourg for a day, visiting to have a shul there. There is still the remnant, you should know, the effects of this Napoleonic Sanhedrin still exist today in France because the Napoleonic Sanhedrin created something called a consistoire, which is the organized rabbinate. It's basically the state version of the Orthodox Union, where all the shuls are under this one aegis. They have also community services and kashrus and whole thing. It's called the consistoire. That was established by the Napoleonic Sanhedrin. So when I went to France, so I met with the chief rabbi of France, who's the head of the consistoire. So Rav David Zinsheim was established as the first, essentially the leader of French Jewry, first acknowledged as the most senior Rav. His family was from the town of Trier, who we spoke about last week, you know, fast forward 100 years to Rabbi Altman, Hashem Yikom Damo Zechus Yaakov Aleinu, who was the Rav of Trier, because Trier in Germany and Salz and Strasbourg, they're like right near each other. When I went to Strasbourg, I decided, you know what? I'd never been to Germany. I was curious. So I took a bus over the Rhine River to Germany. And then I came back 20 minutes later, but I lost the group. They had gone to Colmar and I missed the bus. It's very close by. So Rav David Zinsheim, he was a very chash of a Rav. We're learning now in the Kola, we're learning Maseches Menachos. Most Achronim do not have commentaries on Kachim, on Maseches Menachos, but he does. He was a very chash of a person. When he passed away, the Chasam Sofer was maspid him and said that everything that he did was al pi Taras HaKodesh. As the rabbi of this assembly, and you can imagine how tricky it is, because the fate of essentially the overwhelming majority of European Jews who are under the dominion of Napoleon are in your hands, because if he doesn't like what you answer, you know what he's going to do. It happens to be when they first put back the answers, Napoleon instituted a series of restrictive edicts against Jews. Later he relented on those, but what you say and the nature of how you respond to a question like this, literally people's lives are at stake. And so on the one hand, Rav David Zinsheim, together with others, there was a man by the name of Abraham Ferdado, who is a Portuguese Jew, a lay leader, was also very involved. On the one hand, they had a fealty to halacha. Rav David Zinsheim did, for sure. On the other hand, they had an exigent circumstance. They needed to give an answer to Napoleon. They couldn't just say, yeah, we really don't care. So it's really a very interesting parsha. Very interesting parsha. What were you going to ask?
Ask how they picked the 100-plus people.
So that, I don't know exactly how they picked them. I would have to do some more research to figure out exactly how they picked, but it makes sense to me. I would clearly understand why they would pick Rav David Zinsheim, who was probably the greatest gadol in France. What's the interesting thing to me about this? There are many interesting things, but what's interesting to me today, and why I'm bringing it to your attention that you should be aware of this, is that the composition of the assembly of Jewish notables is interesting to me. That Napoleon felt that it was important that there be a partnership of rabbis and lay leaders. That's part one. Well, let's fast forward now. In 1913, in Obernai. Obernai is a small town in the Alsace region, not far from Strasbourg. A young man, a boy, is born to the family. Their name is Neher. Grows up as André Neher, 1913. He grows up, he becomes a young scholar. He's teaching German in high school, and that's what he's interested in. But when the Germans arrive and start rounding up Jews, he goes into hiding with his father and his brothers, and that's a whole other story. They go into hiding, and André Neher becomes exposed to and spends a lot of time studying Torah and Jewish literature, rabbinic literature, and philosophy. And he has a period of several years where he's devoted to a primary focus of learning Torah. And he emerges after this period of like being sheltered in this cave of learning, he emerges on the French scene to become one of the leading spokesmen of the Jewish community of France until he makes Aliyah, I think in the early 1970s. I'll tell you exactly when it was. It was in 19... I forget when. I think maybe 1974. I forget. So he is a leading authority on Jewish philosophy in France. His particular interest, one of the big influences, is Maharal on his thinking. And this scholar, André Neher, becomes a professor in the University of Strasbourg, because he's in Alsace. And who writes him a letter in 1958 to get his opinion on who is a Jew? Ben-Gurion. Ben-Gurion writes a letter to this French Jew, André Neher, which is the letter that you have either in Hebrew and English in front of you. And that's what I'd like to look at now, because he has a very interesting discussion, a very interesting suggestion. So he starts, if you have it in the Hebrew, in the email that was sent out, you have it both in Hebrew and English. In the Hebrew, in my volume, it's on 76. André Neher, professor Lamada'e Hayahadus, Universitas Strasbourg. Yud Gimel Shvat, Tufshin Yud Tes, January 22nd, 1959, Lichvod, Rosh HaMemshalah, David Ben-Gurion. He says, on the first day of Hanukkah, I received your letter from the 13th of Cheshvan, and I think what you are, I think that you're turning to the sages of Jews around the world is a historic thing. So I'm happy I'm going to try to address your point. So I don't want to focus on the first part of his letter, because a lot of the themes that he deals with in the first part, we've talked about over the previous weeks, that E'efshar lahakhish, number one, that the word Jew has religious implications. That's point number one. And that this has been going on forever. And number two, that even if somebody is not religious in any way, that doesn't affect his Jewishness as long as he is previously Jewish. Then he talks about how the only way to establish Jewishness is according to Jewish law, which is halacha. Okay, so min hanal yotzei, let's go to number two. Based on this, I'm going quickly here until we get to the point that I want to get to in the next page. Number two, he says, ein shum va'ada memshaltit samchuta lahachlit miu yudi umilo yudi. No government authority can decide who's a Jew and who's not. Only the halacha decides that. And that's based dafka samchusa shel rabbanut. The rabbanut, the rabbis, are the only ones who decide who is a Jew. So, maybe you want to tell me that the rabbanut and the memshalah, they should do something separate. But here's the interesting thing. Go after number three, that's when he says yachloku, turn the page, or if you're in the English, go toward the end. And point number four, do you have a point in the English? Yes, point number four. Therefore, I suggest, listen to what his suggestion is. Kipitaron, as an answer to this question, here's what I think we should do. Tiskanes asifa. We should gather an assembly. Hamurkeves kedelahalon. That is comprised of the following. Aleph, a third, are nitzigei hamemshala, are government representatives. Beis, shlish hamishtatfim, they are anashim v'nashmim, men and women who are all kinds of Jews. Lawyers, doctors, psychologists, rabbis, secular, all kinds of people. And then Gimel, shlish hamishtatfim, the next third, rabbanim, rabbis, sha'aleim liftor es ha-she'elo la'achar hishtatfusam ha-pi'ilas b'shak levitari shala'asifa. The rabbis who will ultimately decide this question after they got together with everyone. So I read this letter and I'm thinking, this is the story of French Jews all over again. André Neher is saying, you know what we should do? We should get together a group of Jews, some of whom are rabbanim, some of who are just balabatim, thoughtful people. Let them discuss it among themselves. And after that, have the rabbis decide based on the input of the whole group. It mamish parallels the assembly of Jewish notables, and then the notion that there needs to be a Sanhedrin, there needs to be a Psak Din. Where does this come from? I think it comes from a deep place in the understanding of the nature of halacha. and the interplay between Chachmei HaMasora, the rabbis, and the community. And that is the understanding that these two realms, these two groups, cannot live distinct from each other and disjunct from each other. They need to be in conversation with each other. It's true, of course, the Sanhedrin is only comprised of Chachamim, only rabbis. But there needs to be a precursor to that Psak Din of the rabbis. There needs to be engagement between the Chachamim and the Balabatim. There needs to be consideration and understanding. And this is exactly what the Rambam teaches us in Hilchos Mamrim. If you were here in person, Emir Tzashem will be back together in person soon. You would have the orange sheets that are in front of you. Rambam Hilchos Mamrim, Perek Beis Halacha Hei. The Rambam tells us the following. Based in a rabbinic court, Shenire Lahem Ligzor Gzera, that it seems fitting to them to establish a stricture. Olasakin Takana, or to enact an enactment. Olahanig Minag, or to establish a custom. Tzrichim lehisyashiv bedavar. They have to think about it. So what's the case here? The Chachamim are trying to figure out how to best guide the community from a religious standpoint in a particular circumstance. We're not talking about here about traditional halacha that is based on the halacha l'moshe Mitzrayim or Yud Gimel Midos. That, it is what it is. Kashrus is kashrus. Shabbos is Shabbos. But we're talking about rabbinic leadership, how to answer difficult moral and ethical questions, how to set up social institutions, like Hillel was misakin a prusbol, or we have all kinds of takanas that existed over the years, whether they're bishalakum or pasakum or shemen akum. We have chachamim who are magdir gederugs, gedarim, or gzeros. So the Rambam says, they have to think. Veleda tchila, and first consider, im rov hatzibur yecholim lamod ba'omeinu, rov hatzibur yecholim lamod b'davar zeh. Based on the Gemara in Avodah Zarah Daf Lamed Vav, the Rambam says, they only are going to institute a takana if most people, most of the tzibur, the average folks, not the rabbis, the average folks, can handle this stricture, this minug. Ula olam, and forever, ein gozrin gzera ala tzibor. They can't institute any enactment on the community. Elam kein rov hatzibur yecholim lamod ba. What happens if they make a mistake? They think everybody can handle this. Hare shegozru halacha vav gebezdin gzera. They're going to enact a halacha, a din. And what happens? They think that everybody can handle it. So after they made this rabbinic enactment, turns around, they look around and they say, you know what? Pikpiku ha'amba. The people, they're quibbling with it. The rabbis first thought that people could handle it. They considered what the people would do. And the rabbis thought that people could handle it. And the people say, you know what? Rabbis, we love you, we respect you, we're not in on this one. We're not okay with it. Harizu betela, it's void on its own. Ve'einon rashoin lachuf esam lalechazba. The rabbis cannot coerce the people to follow this din. It has no tokef at all. Now, there's one case where there's kind of an interesting in between. What happens if you have the following? And this is the third level that the Rambam tells us. Level one is the rabbis have to consider what's going to be the effect on the community. The rabbis need to take the feedback of the community into consideration. If the rabbis take the feedback into consideration and they think it's going to work, but there's pushback from the community, it takes no effect. But what if you have a little interesting case like this? Take a look at this. Halacha Zayin. Gazru. They made a takana. Vedimu, and it seemed, Shepashta b'chol Yisrael, that it spread among all Jews. Now this is important. The Lechem Mishnah here points out that This is the concept of acceptance, means that it spread. And you're thinking in your mind, this idea of spreading is going to be interesting in halacha. Spreading where? To whom? Probably the most famous takana, I would guess, I mean, what would you think? Is the Cheron de Rabbeinu Gershom, probably, not to marry more than one wife. Probably the most famous gzeira. So there is a big discussion. Where did that gzeira extend to? Was it only in Ashkenazi communities? France, Germany? What about North Africa? What about Sephardi communities? How long was it binding? So the Rambam says these are really important details. Where did it spread to? How accepted was it? They thought, v'dimu, the rabbis thought, they considered, shepashta b'chol Yisrael v'amar adavar kein shanam rabos, and it lasted like this for a long time. There was a rule on the books. The rabbis thought that everybody was following it. Ula achaz ma meruba, but after a long time, amad bezden acher, another rabbinic court comes along, ubadak b'chol Yisrael, and then they check, v'ra she'ino sa'agzera poshetes b'chol Yisrael. They see that the truth is, most people didn't accept it. What do you do then? They acted initially as if everybody accepted it, but turns out that they really didn't. So it had standing power for a while, but now it doesn't. So the Rambam says something interesting. Yesh lo rishus levatla. Even though normally the Rambam tells you earlier in the perek that if a generation establishes a takana and the Beis Din makes that rule, that special enactment, no later court can undo it unless they are greater both in chachma, in wisdom, and in minyan, in number. But in this case, they can. Any later court could come and abolish it. Why? Because it turns out that people didn't accept it. It existed for a long time, so it seemed like it was accepted. But because it was never fully accepted, then basically anybody can, any rabbinic court could come along and just get rid of it. Even if they were lower, a rabbinical court today that got together to be mevatel something is certainly lower than the court of the Rabbeinu Gershom, of the Rambam, of the Chasam Sofer. Yeshlo levatel, you can undo it. What does this Rambam speak to? Exactly this point. That the rabbis can't exist in some ivory tower disconnected from the community. And even if they did, the Rambam says, it would have absolutely no validity. Of course, the Rambam is telling us that the Beis Din needs to be the one to provide the leadership, but there needs to be communal input. Ad kedei kach, that A, if it was never accepted initially, you don't even have to be mevatelit, it's batel on its own. And on the second level was, even if it seemed like it was accepted, but later it turns out that it wasn't fully accepted and it's fallen apart, then any later Beis Din can come and undo it, because the nature of this partnership is such that it needs both sides. It's true on a general level. I think it's also probably true on an individual level, right? Because this is on the level of stage one of deciding on the legislation. But that's, let's say you could call it the Assembly of Jewish Notables, the idea of having a get-together of all of these nitzigim. That's what Napoleon was doing, and that's what Andrei Neher was suggesting. But they both have the second phase of, we need a Sanhedrin. Now, Napoleon didn't get all the Gedolim together, which is what you would need for a Sanhedrin. And that's exactly what Andrei Neher is suggesting, that based on the feedback, the Rabbanim would paskin. But even those poskim, on an individual level, they have to have a certain sensitivity. Here's an interesting Gemara in Sanhedrin on Daf Lamed Vav. The Gemara tells us in Sanhedrin, Ein moshivin v'sanhedrin zokein usris umisha ein lo bonim. You're not allowed to put on the Sanhedrin somebody who is extremely elderly or is a sris, eunuch, or somebody who has no children. Why not? Why can't it be that someone who's very elderly would serve on the rabbinic court, on the highest court, on the Sanhedrin? You would think, and in our tradition, Mivnei Seva Takum, Tzadik Hatamar Yifrach, the more elderly somebody is, the more venerated they are, because they have more life experience, they have more learning. So Rashi there explains, and many Mepharshim talk about two dayas in the Rishonim. is that a person, they might become so elderly that they're out of touch with the average person. They're out of touch with the rachmanus of what it takes to raise a child, because they're living in their ivory tower somewhere. A person who was ein lo banim didn't have the challenges, the vicissitudes, the struggles, that rachmanus that it takes to raise children. So that person can't sit on the Sanhedrin. Because even when you get to the legislative or the judicial phase that's squarely in the hands of the Sanhedrin, on an individual level, that person needs to be able to feel the community, to feel the effects that it's going to have on the everyday common man, on the individuals. I think it's a very important concept in understanding halacha, and it gives us so much of an appreciation of what's been going on for the last 13 months, where we are blessed, Baruch Hashem, to have, at least in our Torah community, people that we know and who know us. We have great Chachmei HaMasora, we have great Poskim, who when they think about how to give us guidance in halachic areas, whether it relates to how to function in the shul, in tefillah b'tzibur, how to manage for Hilchos Pesach, how to do tons and tons of different things, they're keeping in mind both of these elements. The element of the fealty to halacha, the same tradition as Rav David Zinsheim, the same tradition as the authentic Sanhedrin, that we have a tradition, and that we have to have a fealty to that, a commitment to that. But at the same time, understanding that halacha doesn't exist in a vacuum, and there are human beings, people who are being impacted by this pandemic. And how we regulate the Piske Halacha in any situation where you have a pandemic is going to affect people's lives. And it's going to affect it physically and also emotionally and psychologically. So making sure, and this is what I know I've seen and heard from the Poskim that our community has the benefit of their guidance from, they're constantly in contact with medical professionals, people in the world of mental health, and having that sensitivity to the community is crucial for giving rabbinic guidance. So that, I think, to me, is the thesis that we can learn from these two French episodes that are separated by, you know, quite a few years, from 1806 to 1958, but they're both bringing to the same point that needs to be a take-home for Jews around the world, and our understanding that Yiddishkeit and rabbinic direction is a partnership with the community. It's an understanding, it's a connection to, and it's nurturing that sensitivity. Yashar Koach, everybody. Thank you for joining. Neshama should have an aliyah for Dr. Poland, Zichrono Levracha.